Break room, so.
And.
Okay, Jim. We are ready to roll into BES, so.
Jim, in the few minutes we have remaining, would you please summarize the position and then we'll welcome.
We're in favor.
All right.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Hagerman. I'm interim director for Bureau of Environmental Services. Seated behind me are senior management staff for Bureau of Environmental Services who may appear at the table if the questions get particularly tough. They are Jane Bakiri, Watershed Services, Marvita Redding, Pollution Prevention Services, Bill Ryan, Engineering Services, and Steve Barrett, Wastewater Services. And with me is Michael Harrison, representing the Bureau's BAC. So I'm going to be very brief to allow adequate time for the good stuff to come later. Okay. Here we go. So to summarize briefly, our requested budget addresses, among other things, the following key issues: maintaining and repairing aging infrastructure, of which we have plenty, emergency preparedness, and protection of system assets, both gray and green. It will require a rate increase higher than inflation, and it's driven primarily by our capital requirements, which we'll discuss in a little more detail later on. Wrong way. There we go. So very high-level overview of the budget request. You can see it's $449.3 million. If you look at the bottom, those two large slices of the pie, by far the largest amount relates to capital expenditures. The $104.4 million is capital improvement expenditures, $173.7 million for debt service on revenue bonds sold to finance capital construction in previous years. 117.4 is the operations and maintenance, including Portland Harbor, and then smaller amounts, 29.1, for cash financing of capital construction and some rate stabilization fund transfers. And finally, 24.7 million for general fund, central services, utility license fees, and debt service on pension obligation bonds. So the rest of the presentation is organized around some key priorities and the decision packages in our requested budget that address them. The first is fixing aging and failing public sewer and stormwater infrastructure. Now, we have a lot of assets that are in good or very good condition, but a third of our 2,500 miles of pipe, sewer pipes, are more than 80 years old. We have 97 pumping stations, many of which are relatively new, some of which will need major upgrades in coming years, and the life cycle on those pump stations is substantially shorter than for pipe infrastructure. So we would like to address this in a couple of ways. We have a capital program support decision package, which would add three positions in support of CIP work. This is actually a cost reduction package rather than an enhanced performance package. We currently have about 12,000 hours of overtime worked by technicians at the plant in support of capital projects, and we are proposing to add three positions, which would then substitute straight time for that overtime and actually reduce overall expenditures. The second thing is to increase inspections for manholes at greatest risk of failure. That's part of our capacity management operations and maintenance plan. And the idea there is that we have about 20,000 manholes at highest risk of failure, and we want to put those on a 12-year inspection cycle. So we're proposing to increase our interagency with the Portland Bureau of Transportation to do those inspections. Just to give you a little bit of an overview of the capital improvement program, you see the chart here. We're over the 5 years, we're spending over $500 million in capital. That it's dominated by maintenance and reliability, which should be no surprise. This is as it has been in past years and will continue on into the future, with smaller amounts for sewage treatment, surface water management, and systems development. The next priority is operating and maintaining the public's sewer and stormwater system. The CSO control program, as you know, added a lot of assets to the system, large assets, complicated assets. It also increased the complexity of operating the system, both operating the collection system to capture CSOs and in terms of higher volume at the wastewater treatment plant. plant. We're proposing to address this with a maintaining current service level package, which would add 3 instrument tech positions to reduce our preventive maintenance backlog at the treatment plant and in the collection system, add a position to support training and professional development to maximize the effectiveness of the employees we have, ultimately to improve asset performance and extend the useful life of those assets. The next priority is building a resilient future, by which I mean preparing staff to operate in challenging times. We talk a lot about subduction zone quakes. That's just one example of an emergency. And on the capital side, trying to identify ways that we can harden our system and upgrade our assets in a strategic way. And we propose to do this in 2 ways. We believe that given the obligations that we have for emergency management, the information that we've developed, it is time to add a position to support the Bureau's emergency manager. So we would propose adding an emergency coordinating position for that. And on the capital side, we want to add some outside assistance. This would be through a contract to help us develop a plan to make the system more resilient. And when I say a plan, I don't mean that we want to do a specific thing in the next 5 years, but we'd like to answer the following type of question. If we set as a goal, and this is just for example, that we would like to recover from a magnitude 9 earthquake, recover all key services within 30 days, what would it take us to get there in, let's say, 20 years?
You know, what? I would just like to note for the record that Commissioner Novick was nodding approvingly as you said that.
The next category is providing opportunity and promoting equity. So educational opportunities for students, we believe, build awareness and interest in employment and allow us to reach diverse pools of potential help. And enhanced recruitment also widens and diversifies the applicant pool. So we'd like to take kind of an upstream approach to this, and we're proposing to do several things. First, to add a Clean Rivers education position to expand our presence in our programs, educational programs, preferably with the current balance, which is more toward Title I schools, which generally have as kind of greater than 50% of their students are on lunch assistance. So it's an indicator of a challenged community. But we also want to use that additional position to develop a curriculum for a cohort program within the Bureau that will take both high school students from underrepresented communities and college students and introduce them to the Bureau, to different business areas in the Bureau, and ultimately certify them as having completed this curriculum, and we hope get them interested in working for us or in other technical positions down the road. And finally, we'd like to add some support for targeted outreach in our recruitment, which may include advertising, but may also include travel to national conferences for targeted employee groups or groups of potential employees. The next priority is protecting and extending the life, protecting and extending the lives of city assets, and I'm glad it's not lunchtime right now.
Does that slide indicate why we have the Fats Oil and Grease program?
Yes. This was the last time I deep-fried a turkey at home. That's my branch. So city assets, once built, are vulnerable in a variety of ways. You can discharge toxic things into them that will upset the treatment process at the plant or corrode the pipes or contaminate groundwater. And you can add fats, oils, greases, and other types of obstructors to the sewage line, so flushable wipes being one example, that result in sewage overflows and property damage. And then there are reported spills of unknown materials. Customers make them to us, they expect a prompt response, and so we work hard to be prompt in our response to those calls. So we would propose to address that with a decision package that would add a field specialist position to provide support for increased sampling workloads, and that could be sampling of stormwater quality. It could be sampling in the sewer pipes to help trace contaminants back to their source. And we'd like to add an environmental tech position to enhance the response time for reported spills as well. So to try to wrap it up briefly, here is what the requested budget would mean for an average residential monthly bill. And you can see of the $67.76 for sewer, stormwater, and superfund, about 52% of that is debt service payments, principal and interest on revenue bonds. So we are a capital-driven bureau. $21.65, or about 32%, is for sewer, stormwater system operations and maintenance. About $5.69 for system improvements, that's cash financing of capital construction, and the remainder being either transfers to rate stabilization fund, utility license fees, central services, and Portland Harbor Superfund. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. We can save that for later, and we can have Michael Harrison.
Got a couple, maybe throw a couple on the table and then both of you can
sure.
respond. One is, your budget shows $140 million in contingency. Given the completion of the big project, what's that for? And then secondly, have you and or the BAC talked about where you are with respect to what you're charging and how current you are on systems development charges? I know that discussion is underway in parks, so I'm curious.
Mayor,
as to
can we hold on the SDCs?
Sure.
Because mm-hmm. we're going to have the CUB is going to present some testimony on SDCs, and we'll respond to that.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
take your first question.
Okay. We should probably get you a more specific answer on the contingency. We can break that down for you later, but I would say that it's kind of a catch-all category for us and includes a variety of quite large fund balances. Okay. Okay. So, Michael?
Sure. My comments are pretty brief. I'm Michael Harrison, and I was on the BES Budget Advisory Committee. We met over a period of from October of last year to January this year 7 times, representing citizens as well as folks representing various industries. Nearly everyone who was on the committee went in sort of fervently hoping that we would find some sort of silver bullet that would allow us to make recommendations that could reduce rates, and despite sort of many probing questions and a lot of research that we did and information requests with the Bureau, ultimately we came around to supporting the increase that they recommended, simply because given the great magnitude of the investment that the public already has in the system, to try to skimp on maintenance and capital improvements to the system doesn't seem wise. You know, sort of as compelling is the issue of livability. You can't really ask your citizens to accept sewer backups, for example. Is my mic doing weird things?
Yes,
sorry, so I'll just speak louder. You can't really expect citizens to expect sewer backups into their sewer and feel like they're part of a livable community, for example. So there's certain things that are just basic services that you can't skimp.
Okay,
actually,
other questions?
I do have a question for Michael, which is, when we get outraged emails from constituents saying that the city is wasting all of its money on this green storm sewer stuff, can we give them your phone number?
Commissioner Novick, I'm also glad you mentioned that because the Bureau has, and it's largely occurred during your tenure, come to council on some big capital projects and shown two different ways of getting to the finish line. One is the sort of traditional gray, and one is gray and green, and then given a return on investment. And we've done that because we wanted to be clearer about the economic benefits of engaging gray and green, separate and apart from the environmental benefits. And everybody can put their own price on what it is to have shade, green, you know, a softer landscape, cleaner air, cleaner water. You can put a value on that. But what we've learned, like in Tabor to the River and some of these other big capital projects, is that gray and green actually saves ratepayers money, which we think that customers want to hear that first before we laud the environmental benefits.
But, I mean, that, in all seriousness, that's a very important message to get out, because I really have gotten many, many emails from people saying, how dare you be asking for more money from the streets when you're spending all your money on these planters and bioswales and so forth. And I tell them, first of all, it's not fungible money. Second of all, BES makes the case that it actually saves money. And to have independent citizen observers confirming that, I think, is very important.
So I had a question about Package 6. How many existing deputy directors are there? I mean in BES. Okay. I have concerns about in a time when rates are going up at rates higher than inflation, even though we know that this is a tiny drop in the bucket, you know, ratepayers are going to see that you're hiring more high-level managers, and that's going to set some of them off. I'm just saying.
So, Rob, in fairness, since I put the deputy director position on the table for consideration, it was my experience, for example, at Parks, that once upon a time had an assistant to the director but no deputy director, that some of these larger bureaus are better served by having a deputy director who functions more like a COO. And since BES is a mammoth infrastructure bureau, and, you know, Jim is a person of great talent, lots of energy, but he can't be everywhere at all the time. We felt that having a deputy director in the nature of a COO, someone who kept the trains running so the director could be freed up to do a whole range of other important functions, was useful. And the benefits were we documented through Parks, where the Parks director was freed up to spend more time with community groups, more time out in the community, more time with council members, more time formulating policy, less time sitting in labor management committees, less time dealing with other nitty-gritty stuff. So the goal, the request we have in this budget cycle is to create a deputy director position in both of the utilities. And your point's well taken about there's a cost. But we think we can make the case over time that there's also a tremendous benefit to the good functioning of the Bureau.
And I would just say that my assertion was not that there's no efficacy to this. I think that there is. Often the very things that you were citing. But I think doing it in a year where you're asking ratepayers for rates that are above the rate of inflation is bad optics. I'm just saying. I mean, I think your points are exactly on point. But at the same time, I don't think it looks good.
I would be remiss if I didn't also note that the rates that we're proposing are well below the forecast. So yeah. We have to do a better job pointing out that we've scrubbed the forecast numbers to get to these rates, even with the addition of a deputy director. So there's been a lot of scrubbing and sharpening of our pencil to get to the combined 4.8, which, by the way, if you live in places like Tualatin, 4.8 is going to look like a real bargain, where they're going to look at double-digit rate increases for as far as the eye can see. And we don't want to make a recommendation to council above inflation. The reality is that the kind of rate increases we're proposing are already making Hobbesian choices about things like resilience and other things. And if I think our customers on the west side, for example, knew how much risk there was to the system in the event of a seismic event, they might have a different view of our scheduled investments, even in something like resilience. But we've made a lot of tough choices. They have consequences. And I'm hoping that after making those tough choices, we can also make the case that a deputy director position long-term is in ratepayers' interest.
I found it quite astonishing that we didn't already have one. And especially with some of the challenges we've had with the transition in leadership, and Jim is doing a great job, but it really evidences that a bureau this size with this huge of a budget needs a team at the top to make sure that the bureau runs properly.
Other questions? Well, yeah, I just wanted to ask about the debt service. Is that usual that you'd have that much debt in the rate, built right into the rate? It's like, it's more than half, isn't it? Half of the rate is debt service?
Yes. It is a consequence of $1.4 billion spent on combined sewer overflow control. Which
so it's the big pipe.
It's, the bulk of it is the big pipe. It's not entirely a big pipe, but yeah, much
and
of
is
it
that,
is.
And is that, what is the, what would you like it to be? I mean, other than zero. What would be, is there a standard, an industry standard around that?
All I can say is that the bond rating agencies give us a reasonably solid investment grade rating despite the debt.
Mm-hmm.
So if we wanted to be AAA like water, you would probably want it half that or lower.
And how quickly is it going to get to that? How long is that debt going to be sitting there?
Much of it's 25-year debt, and so we're looking at 2030 or later before that is all retired.
So we'll all be retired.
Yes.
Chart right here, it's in the budget proposal itself, and that's 2043.
Oh, 2043, okay.
Also, Katie, one of the reasons it's difficult for Jim to tell you where we are in terms of an industry standard is that, for better or worse, Portland was a front runner, was an early adopter to the CSO.
Mm-hmm.
We have peer cities like Atlanta and other cities around the country. They're going to have to undertake similar projects, take on a lot of debt. The difference is it's going to cost them a heck of a lot more than it cost us.
Mm-hmm.
But we are slightly ahead of the curve in terms of peer cities making this kind of investment.
Mm-hmm. So I just have some feedback on your dashboard, which for the most part I really like. And what was I going to say? Single family household bill as percentage of median income. What I really like about that is the fact that you have it on there, that you have some kind of a measure of cost to the to our citizens. And although I get the feeling that the way it's framed is so that it will look like a small number, like one, oh, it's only 1.46. Is that the best way to express that? And I, knowing nothing about it, had you to work to get that, or was it something that everybody uses, or?
Well, as part of the CSO controls enforcement process, EPA takes a look at median income, or the sewer bill as a percentage of median income. And if you're below 2%, you're not considered to be highly stressed.
You're what?
You're not considered to be highly stressed financially.
Okay.
So 2% is kind of the, you know, you're really getting quite high.
So it sounds like it is kind of a standard to use something like mm-hmm. that. And would you ever measure, like, households that weren't part of a single family? I mean, how do they get measured, or is that?
Generally, you measure single family households.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is when you start looking at the distribution of incomes around the metro area and, you know, comparing the percentages there, and you do find that there are, you know, subsections of the community that are stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typically why you do low-income assistance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Questions or comments or follow-up requests? Dante?
Go ahead. I had two questions. One, both of them kind of big-picture ones. One is, what impact, if any, do you think the climate disruption will have in your operations and your budget? Will having more frequent, more severe weather events have an impact on your system, even in terms of operations or cost?
It easily could. And if we want to get more into that, I'd probably call Bill Ryan up. But I would say that anytime you have more violent swings in the weather, you're going to have more upsets in the system, and you'll need to make investments to deal with that.
The second question is kind of an historical one. At some point in the distant past, we built this system, and I would imagine it cost a heck of a lot to build a sewer system from scratch. And I would like to know, do we have any historical data on how it was paid for? What were the sewer rates in 1885 or whenever we started building the system?
Because
I think it would actually be useful to have that to tell people that, look, if you'd been here when we were building the system in 1885, you would have been paying a much larger percentage of your income.
Steve, there was a very celebrated ballot fight in 1886 over a proposed water district to take it away from the city because the people thought the sewer rates were too high.
Yesterday was April Fool's. So actually, one piece of the story that I think is generally accurate, which is that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Bureau got a fair amount of federal grant money.
And that's correct. For I believe for constructing the secondary treatment, or was it the primary treatment? Secondaries, yeah.
Yeah, that is no longer the case. I know you'll be shocked to hear that the federal government is not as good a partner as they used to be.
Other questions, comments, follow-up?
And Janice here to talk about the Cubs' findings and recommendations.
I think your letter's in the packet.
It looks like this.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
I have some spares too.
It was emailed. It was emailed.
Ms. Janice, you've got it.
Good afternoon. Janice Thompson, Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. So this memo touches on two topics. One was foreshadowed by Mayor Hale's question about system development charges. So let me start there. There's two categories of system development charges that are mapped out in, you know, state law. It's a very straightforward, kind of more economic calculation process. So there was a reference to parks, SDCs, and the process is very different. And the one category in the sewer utility world is the sanitary sewer and the stormwater drainage facility. Now, the chart kind of outlines that, I guess about 5 years ago, the sanitary sewer SDC was reduced and then frozen. And no catch-up steps, you know, have been taken since that time, which means there's this kind of this continued differential between what's charged and what is allowed under state law.
So, Janice, for those of us who don't know how sanitary SDCs are assessed, could you just give us a couple of sentences on that?
Why don't you do it? Okay. I could, but he's really the total expert, so why not have him do it?
Anyway, Commissioner, you are allowed to take, in our case, since we do a backward-looking SDC, you take the cost of essentially the system major facilities and divide them by the capacity of the system in terms of equivalent dwelling units, and then you get a cost per equivalent dwelling unit. So for a major facility like a trunk line or, you know, treatment plant facilities, we're allowed to calculate the costs of those, and we can use replacement cost for that under Oregon law. And once we have that whole amount of cost for the major system facilities, then we divide that by the capacity, and we use secondary treatment capacity, EDUs, equivalent dwelling units. And that gives you a cost per EDU, and that would be the cost for a single-family dwelling.
So is that when there's already a sewer system there?
Well, what it represents is the contribution made by prior ratepayers to building the system. And so when you, as a new ratepayer, enter the system, then you're essentially reimbursing prior ratepayers for having built the excess capacity to accommodate you. That's why it's referred to as a reimbursement charge.
So you're connecting to the pipe, and you figure out how many units are already connected to the pipe and how much it cost?
How much it cost and what the total capacity is. So when you connect to the pipe, you're essentially buying your share of that total capacity cost.
Because you build bigger capacity. It's not like every time that something comes in, you say, oh, we have to, like, increase the capacity. The capacity has been built to a greater degree from the get-go. And so that has to be reimbursed.
We're not building a new park to to deal with the impact of new development. We're just building a tiny little trail to the new park and charging people for the cost that's already been invested.
That's helpful because it is obviously right. Very different from parks, but essentially you're buying into the system
exactly.
With your SDC.
But that's partly why it's a more cut and dried kind of economic calculation. It is kind of mapped out in state law. Obviously it looks different in suburban communities where there's more new development, but unless already built up infrastructure. But so that's what it is. And like I say, might as well have the expert explain it. But,
so then explain to me the bit about frozen. How could it be frozen?
It as allowed under state law, it could have been in 2012, 2013, $4,779. Instead, it was frozen at the previous year level of, wait a minute, where is it here? Well, I got to go back.
And did we make that decision or did state law make a decision?
This was a city council decision.
Great.
Council froze a lot of fees and charges during the recession.
Yeah. And it's really evidence that this is my seventh time through this, and you're making it very transparent, and CUB is also bringing to light so that I haven't been asking these questions for the last 7 years. So thank you.
So CUB's proposal is to return to what the city had historically done, which is to charge the full amount. So this isn't a situation of like, oh, there's been this chronic shortage in terms of what the SDC has been. The norm has been charge the full amount allowed under law. It wasn't done for a couple years. Once that gets started, as the chart goes, just like it kind of starts to build because you never did a catch-up step. So it's time to do that catch-up step. In 2013-2014, which is the last fiscal year for which the books are finalized, the amount additional revenue would have come to $2.8 million. As I understand it, the estimate for the current fiscal year is about $2.5 million would come in. So, CUB recommends beginning in the current budget year, 2015-2016, to start a process of over this year and then the next fiscal year to catch up and kind of phase in moving back up to that fully allowed level.
So just so I understand that absent that catch up, what you're saying is essentially we're transferring costs of new developments to the wide base of ratepayers. Is that right?
Right. In effect, 85% is being charged. And one way to think about that is if a customer called up and said, geez, I only want to pay 85% of my sewer bill, they would be turned down. So it is really a situation where other ratepayers are subsidizing subsidizing the system.
Can I just, to put this into layman's terms, Jim, if we collected another $2.5 million in SDCs, what would be the potential rate impact, all things being equal?
It would be about a 0.2% reduction in the increase. And I say that because we are back into a regime where we're using rate stabilization to smooth over all 5 years of the plan. And so that tends to blunt the immediate impact if we smooth. So that's about what it would be.
But when you think about it, back in 2003, 2014, when those 2.8 million that was kind of foregone revenue, if I remember right, the average residential rate increase that year was 5 point something, higher than it is now. Would have been a particularly good year to have been able to provide, to ratchet it down even, like you say, by 0.2 or some smaller percent.
Well,
let me be very clear, Janice. If, 2/10 of a percent combined with, let's say, favorable interest rates, combined with some other belt tightening and other things, starts adding up. So we look at it as a cluster of potential savings that then have a rate impact. And since sewer and stormwater is 2/3 of the bill, then it has a bigger impact on the overall bill than if it was a savings within water.
Right. So that's the recommendation related to the sanitary sewer SDCs.
This is kind of a tangentially related question, but it seems like the best time to bring it up. I've been having an email exchange recently with a constituent who's convinced that density drives up costs. And part of my response to him has been that I think that in terms of water and sewer, we have more capacity than we absolutely need. So actually, when new people come on, it spreads the cost of operating the existing system among more people. And I just thought this seemed like an appropriate time to ask if that is accurate.
Yes, I mean, in a big picture sense, I mean, these are systems with a lot of fixed costs, and if you can increase the number of people, customers, you increase that. You know, you have more people to spread over the costs. You know, the more dense development, I think it's fair to say, are not, you know, apartment dwellers, you know, smaller households, newer construction with more default, you know, higher levels of conservation for, you know, water-related appliances. I mean, the demand doesn't increase dramatically.
As one minor caveat, I'd just say that if density drives capacity needs above the capacity of the built system, then that would add costs for upsizing. But as long as it doesn't, I think.
And I mean, how close are we to density requiring expansions of the system?
I can't answer that now.
We're not close because of the design of our system being considering planning about the future population.
So the flip side of that question is, I understand your point, and I agree with it, that we ought to be catching up and keeping up with respect to what the methodology allows us to charge for STCs, get that, like that. Flip side of the question, though, in examining that carefully is, if development stopped, what would happen to those capital investments and the rates that otherwise would support them? In other words, if we had another 2008, and it wouldn't matter very much what was in our SDC schedule of payments because we wouldn't be getting very many of them, what impact would that
have? You're left with a choice of either reducing bureau expenditures or raising rates.
By more. So that the funds that come in through this door go into the pool of capital investment dollars that we spend. We don't segregate that. These are SDC capital investments. They're system improvements and program replacements, right?
Well, that's the beauty of a reimbursement charge. Right. It doesn't have to be spent directly on capital improvements. It can be used to pay debt service as well, which makes it essentially interchangeable with operating dollars. And so it has a very good rate impact.
Okay, much different than an improvement fee where you have to
identify
the new capacity like the parks. Okay.
But it speaks to in general. I mean, this is not like, you know, the figures we've tossed out, it's not like we know that's going to be a level of additional revenue from here on out. It's obviously linked to, you know, development patterns and things like that. But especially now since we're in a better economic time, it seems like the time to catch up on this category.
So, Janice, I really hope you come back on April 15th when we're going to be discussing parks SDCs, because I think there's a very similar principle involved.
Okay. One other question. In your table, allowed SDC, is that the equivalent residential unit? Is that the single family charge? Yeah. What is that number?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be the EDU charge, and that would be a single-family equivalent.
Okay.
Yes.
But I assume that we're behind the curve on commercial and industrial SDCs at a similar percentage. Okay, this is a system
a rate system problem. Wasn't Correct. That we were just being particularly easy on single family homes?
No.
Okay.
So the along, kind of similar, but not identical. There's a set, some of the fees that are charged by BES. CUB is recommending boosting up the percentage of cost recovery. One category relates to the fees charged for building plan review and land use review. Again, development-related charges. And so if this adjustment's made, it should be phased in. And one question there is what the recovery goal should be. It does seem valid to not have the cost recovery goal be 100%. And one not exact, you know, analogy is, you know, businesses, if they were totally focused on cost recovery, would always charge for delivery fees. But, you know, they want to get more customers in. It's to the advantage to all ratepayers to get more customers, kind of along your line of your earlier question, Commissioner Novick. So CUB suggests that it's, in these categories of fees, an 80 to 90% cost recovery goal is on target. Again, for 2013-2014, some of the figures BS provided, very helpfully, was that these categories, the land use related, building plan related fees, was only 50%, so about a 30% kind of shortfall. And that if that 80% goal had been met, an additional about $100 million would have, you know, come in. Again, this is not a dollar figure that, you know, you then would see from here on out. All these are going to fluctuate. Then in terms of the other types of fees, there's an industrial waste discharge program that charges a fee that's right now only at 55% of direct costs. But that's just the direct costs and doesn't include all the overhead items. And so here, the CUB's recommendation is to move it up to 100% of the direct costs, but it's still not 100% of the net cost because you're not kind of dealing it with the full universe of those costs, if that makes sense. The foregone revenue looked to have been about $500,000. So, you know, again, for the 2013-14, if you kind of add it all up, it would be about $4.3 million, which if you're, you know, it would nudge that 0.2% up, you know, a little bit more.
Janice, I misspoke. The 0.2% is all in, so okay. That includes all the fees that we discussed.
Okay, that actually I was a little surprised. Okay, so that two, yeah, that's fine. But that 2%, it adds up, and like you say, once you kind of start doing it, you just keep it up. So again, CUB is recommending in those categories of fees to move up to those cost recovery goals. In a two-year span, again beginning in the fiscal year budget that's being discussed now, and then the following one.
Thank you very much.
That's very helpful.
Janice, the last person we'll call upon is the distinguished director of the Office of Equity, Dante.
Microphone shortage. Thank you, distinguished commissioner. I appreciate it. Just a couple comments. One, I want to comment and commend BES on some of the work that certainly Marvita Redding is doing in trying to work with the youth, high schools, underserved populations, et cetera. And I think the request here, the Clean Rivers Education Program, speaks to that. As I think CBO commented, and she and I have spoken, you know, how do we the best to ensure who we are targeting? The anecdotal evidence is there now, just to really to get concrete information on who we are, targeting how many youth we're addressing, those kinds of things, I think, will really solidify the importance of the program. Also, not in their budget request specifically, but just want to comment on the watershed program and the importance of that and the benefits to that and the equity lens that BES has begun to use in the investment fund portion of the watershed program, I think speaks to their work. And also in terms of their capital improvement projects, have had conversations in the past, and I would ask and challenge them to continue the conversations because prioritization is often based on risk, and there are different types of risk that go into that evaluation and prioritization. And so balancing that and determining the type of risk best used in making those priorities, I think, is still an ongoing conversation, or can be, to best determine where and who is most impacted in the city. So I would just suggest those continuing conversations. But I appreciate the work.
I did have one more question. It was about the KPMs. I noticed that for the percentage of urgent public health and safety-related service requests responded to within a two-hour time frame, that the Bureau has held steady for the last couple of years at 98%, but the projected number for the next, you know, for this year is 90%, and for next year is 90%, which is a somewhat significant drop-off, I think. What's the dynamic in there, and is that something that the Bureau sees, has an interest in improving, or is 90% a target number, or?
90% is the target number.
Oh. So we're gets back to my question about target numbers.
Okay. Other questions, Chris?
During the R Streets discussion, we had a lot of discussion about regressivity of various city services, and water and sewer was noted as being extremely regressive. Has there been ongoing conversation around that, and what's happening?
Not a lot internal to the Bureau, an ongoing conversation about that. I think there has been conversation about potentially enhancing the low-income discount program, and so I think that's where most of the interest has been.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, what was your reaction to the Citizens Utility Board's request? Is that something that the Bureau is considering, or do you have a reaction to it?
Yes. In general, having begun with the Bureau as a rate economist, I'm kind of pro-cost recovery. This is an ongoing issue that we face year in and year out, because obviously there are constituencies for each of these rates, and they impact people differently. And so there is always pushback. So it's kind of nice to get an external perspective on this. Mm-hmm. I will say that the fees and the SDCs are a little bit different, in the sense that in the fee we're kind of behind, and so if you go to full cost recovery, it's kind of a one and done, and then it kind of drifts up with general Bureau costs. In the case of the SDC, it can be a little different, in the sense that the SDC that's allowed will increase with the value of your assets, and that can, and in our case, has gone up more rapidly than rates in general, because we're doing a lot of construction and adding a lot of asset value. So that's a situation that, in principle, you could find yourself in every year, where you've got an SDC that could go up by 8 or 9% while your rates are going up by 3%. So, you know, you have to take that every year in the decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. But you are considering it. I mean, I didn't get everything that you just said, mm-hmm. but it sounded like what you were saying is that, yes, you are considering it. You would like to recover as much full cost as you can, but there's some complexity to it.
I can answer that one, Katie, because the CUB has made, in this budget cycle, very thoughtful recommendations with concerning both utilities. Mm-hmm. And yes, we will be reviewing them and making recommendations back to council.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Sure.
Just one follow-up to Jim's point about the kind of, you know, average residential rate percentage potentially going up. And with the SDCs being kind of calculated in this different way, the percentage of increase being higher. And as I mentioned there, it's kind of an inappropriate and false equivalency to think it's appropriate for those to match up. It's kind of two different beasts. And again, you know, if you don't let the SDCs kind of go, go to the level that is legally allowed, you do have this reduction rate that, you know, like I say, if somebody called up and said, geez, you know, you're only charging developers 85% per EDU of what you could apply, don't you think you should, you know, knock that off my bill? And the answer would be no. So it's a kind of it's two different categories, and so it's okay to have those rates not be in lockstep. If that.
True.
Yeah. Okay.
Point. Okay. Anything else, Commissioner Fish? Anything else?
Yeah. Just to wrap up, Mayor. Thank you. First, we want to thank Claudio and the team at the Budget Office for the partnership and the helping us pull this together. I want to thank Jim Blackwood from my team, who is the liaison to this bureau in my office. We want to thank the Janice and Cub, and she will be appearing as a regularly in all of our budget proceedings, offering independent advice on behalf of our residential ratepayers, and we're very grateful for that partnership. I want to thank Michael and the folks, the citizens who looked at our budget, and this is the last year that we will have a back make a presentation. The recommendation will be coming to council probably in April, based on the Blue Ribbon Commission's recommendations, will be to create a pub, and the pub will function as the standing budget committee for both utilities. So, Michael, thank you very much for your service. And this is also the last time that Jim will be appearing before us as an acting director. And Jim did not, a number of months ago, Jim did not know that his life was going to become this complicated. But when we asked him to step up, he did, and he's done a superb job. And it has not been the easiest few months in his life, so I wanted to especially acknowledge and thank Jim for his tremendous leadership at the helm of this great bureau.
Thank you, Jim. You're here. Thank you. Thank you all. Okay. Take another 2-minute break and dive into water.